Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. I'm here during this hour with Roger, the president of the Troubled Times nonprofit, to talk about soil, gardens, seed saving, different plants, gardening techniques, root cellars, all kinds of related matter like that. Welcome, Roger.
Hello.
So, Roger, when did you get into gardening? This is something that's been in your family, has it not?
Yes. My dad started gardening. Well, when he was a child, I guess, his dad taught him, and he started his own garden when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and of course I was big enough to pick up a hoe, so that was when I started.
At your father's knee. I also had some experience. I spent my summers up at the family homestead, and I would garden with my grandmother, who had raspberry bushes and that type of thing, and learned to love the soil. We have good loamy soil here. Speaking of soil, there's acid soil and the other kind, alkaline soil, and one can modify the pH, but not that readily. Right, Raj?
Exactly. The problem is, to get an acid soil, you have to put a lot of different things on it to try to get it down. There's no really any one thing that works best. Sometimes lime can do it, but it really depends upon what causes your pH to be high. Raising your pH, if you have an acidic soil and you want to balance it, is a bit easier, especially for the average person. You can make a bonfire of your leaf trimmings or tree branches and just take the ashes and spread them right on the garden. And that the ashes, when they get wet, will make sodium hydroxide, which is a base, and that will raise the pH to closer to something neutral. So that's pretty easy to do. But going the other way and making an acidic soil is more difficult.
Yeah, actually, what you were talking about with the wood ashes, that's how you make lye for soap, is to put wood ashes in a drain and run water through it, and the water that comes out is a weak lye. And then you cook that down with animal fats, and it makes soap. So that's using wood ashes to make lye to make the soil more alkaline. I've heard that leaves will eventually make a soil acidic. In other words, from the trees, if you let it sit on the ground and till it in, that is a tendency to make an acid soil.
Yeah, what it does is it draws a lot of the nitrogen in its decay process and can create some ammonia like substance or raises the or lowers the pH or increases the acidity by drawing out the nitrogen and that odor you smell is kind of ammonia like and that certainly is the acid.
The best I think is probably just to go with whatever kind of soil you have, but there's plants that just won't grow in a soil that doesn't have the right pH, or they don't grow well. I know onions seem to like an acid soil.
Mm-hmm. Potatoes will do much better in an acidic soil.
Ah.
They really love, and that's where if you can get your hands on some lime and work it into the soil, and they say that just makes potatoes go crazy. And it does have some benefits in that way. I've seen where gardens that have been made alongside of a gravel road tend to survive with potatoes and onions and things like that.
Because the gravel is like a lime?
Exactly. Gravel commonly is limestone, just ground up.
Most plants are not all that picky.
Exactly.
Yeah, but they care about light. Some plants really want a lot of intense light. Others like shade.
Mm-hmm.
Although most food that we grow in the garden would just prefer full sunlight, right?
Exactly.
Right. And I'm trying to think of what prefers shade, and I don't believe there is anything in the food category. There's just some exotic flowering plants or the like.
there's some plants that will do well in shade, but almost every plant, like you said, that you want to grow to harvest to eat is going to do better in full light conditions.
Yeah. Have you ever had an experience where there was an awful lot of overcast weather so that the garden didn't get full sun, and how did it do in those instances?
Well, the plants are usually tall and what you say spindly.
Yeah.
Not so many leaves. More stems, because the plant really is just trying to reach for any light it can get. Sometimes you can see the stems will be more of a lighter color, not the deep green, more of a light green or even white sometimes, and not exactly white, but like an off-white. Anyway, that's pretty much. And then, of course, almost no blooming if it's a blooming plant, like tomatoes, for instance. Won't bloom if they don't have enough light.
Sunlight,
yeah.
I have an extra lot next to my house here, and the family garden we have is not quite filling that lot at all, and that's plenty of tomatoes and greens and corn and potatoes and that kind of thing for the family to eat. And if I was saving, I think, a squash, some of that for the root cellar, or onions for the root cellar, it would be producing enough for that also. So you don't need all that much space. I'm thinking of the movies I've seen where there's a garden next to the little cottage on the plains, and they have a fence around the garden to keep the critters out. And it's not all that huge. It seems almost maybe just as big as the cottage, or twice as big as the cottage, because you garden intensively,
right?
And you use all the soil surface.
Yeah, I can say that whenever I've had a garden successfully in different places that I've lived, it's usually been on the order of a couple of hundred square feet, and has done well for a family of three. Of course, you supplement a lot, and there are some things that you just can't grow well, or you can't preserve well, and so you still go to the grocery store. But at the height of my dad's gardening, when we were a family of six, he had nearly 4,000 square feet dedicated to gardening, but he did a lot of seed saving. So I would estimate that about half, maybe three-fourths of that garden was actually put away.
Am I doing my math right? 200 feet by 200 feet? 4,000 square feet?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's actually like a large house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Not all that big.
No.
Yeah. You know, I'm remembering when they did Biosphere 2 in Arizona, and it was an experiment to see if people could live. They had this troop of actors that they put in there to live for 6 months. They had a desert area and a rainforest area. And one of the problems that developed, in addition to keeping, they had a cockroach in there, a couple cockroaches, and so it became a real bug problem. But
yeah.
I remember being surprised that one of the biggest problems they had was the lack of oxygen, because they were trying to create soil. They took sand and manure, cow manure, and they were mixing it together, and they were going to, like, rather than pick up loamy soil from somewhere, truckload after truckload, they were using something handy that they had, which was something from a manure from a ranch and sand in the area, and mixing it together, and said, okay, this will be really good soil, you know, have a lot of natural fertilizer in it. And apparently, when you're making soil and you're having decomposition in manure or compost, it pulls in a lot of oxygen and binds it. And so they were all dying of oxygen deprivation, and they had to pump something in. I mean, there was no question about breaking the rule that nothing should enter or leave the biosphere. But in nature, out there, when you have a compost pile and you're turning it and the like, no such worry, because you have access to the atmosphere.
Yeah. In soil, there's three components that you really need to look for. And there's the plant material and the sand, which, you know, you mentioned those two things in the biodome experiment. But then the third component is clay. And clay really helps with moisture retention. And so you need to have a fair amount of that in your soil as well. you want to test your soil and find out what your components are, so you can see if you need to add some more plant material or more sand or something, you just take a handful of your soil and put it in a glass jar or fill it with water and stir it around and so it's pretty well mixed in. You know, make some kind of a chocolate milk looking thing and then leave it sitting on the countertop and check it the next day and it'll separate out and you'll see the sand in one layer and the clay in another layer and the plant material in another layer and you can really just kind of get a good idea of what those proportions are. And there are many different arguments about what's the right proportion, and I would just say use your own best judgment. If you see that you have 3/4 of that those layers is all sand, then you know you need to add something else to it, and so on. So use your own gut feeling, and if you don't have a good gut feeling, then consult with the local expert or a book or something and see what you need to add. But really just keep in mind there are 3 components as well.
I have a compost pile, but I haven't really done what a lot of people do, turn it and then mix it in the garden, although I do mix the chicken droppings in and let that cook for a while well ahead of the time that I'll be planting anything, because I know that this is very rich and I think it just gets hot as it's breaking down, and people talk about it being hot and burning the plants. I'm not sure what that process is. I don't think that's heat. I think that's a chemical problem that the plants won't grow, maybe too acid or too alkaline, probably that.
Yeah.
So do you have a compost pile?
Of course, yeah.
Uh-huh. And what's the technique? What would you say, I mean, is it kind of like a rolling thing? The fresh stuff is on top or fresh stuff is in one end and then the stuff that is cooked and cooked down and processed is at the other end? Is that how you do it, or do you just keep turning it?
Similar. What works best, again, is what I was trained with my dad, and that is you have 3 bins. You make like a square box and you know, 3 square boxes side by side, and then you just move it from one bin to the next, and fresh stuff goes in one end, and then when it gets full, you put it in the middle, and that, of course, turns it, and then whenever that's full, then you move it to the last one, and of course, that's turning it again. And by the time it gets to the end bin, it pretty much looks just like dirt, like soil.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when you said turning it, you mean that you actually, like, flip it upside down, or you shovel it out of one bin and put it into the next?
Shovel out of one and put it in the next, yeah. So
uh-huh.
it's mixing it and turning it right then, and also, it's putting air back into it, too, which is the big thing, is to get air in there. It needs a lot of air circulation. And depending upon how you construct your bin, how you construct the box, it may not get any airflow or get minimal airflow. You have to arrange it kind of like a flat box where it has some gaps between the boards so it can get some airflow.
Yeah.
But what really, really is the biggest advantage, if you can get a hold of some nitrogen or something that's rich in nitrogen, to pour in there. And what I've used is blood meal, and it's just dried blood that's been ground up into a powder, and it provides that nitrogen that the bacteria needs to really start working on that material. And they say that you can get a bin processed within 30 days.
Oh, wow.
You just keep it enriched with nitrogen.
Yeah. Well, actually, you could get that from should one live next to a slaughterhouse. I imagine they have plenty of that.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a byproduct of slaughtering, you know, that the blood runs down the drains, huh?
Yeah.
And they collect it. Hmm. Earthworms. Earthworms turn the soil a lot. And do you find that in your compost bin that they come up out of the ground and are in and out of the compost like crazy?
Oh, yeah.
They eat it, and then they... what comes out the other end of the worm is close to soil.
Yeah.
And break it down. That's their job. But are there things that you can't put in a compost pile? Like you wouldn't want to put garbage, right? You wouldn't want to put spoiled meat, for instance,
no, definitely
right?
Not. Two reasons for that. The obvious reason is any animal product that you put in there is going to attract other animals to come and eat it. And so the dogs and the cats in your neighborhood, or or worse, the coyotes or wolves that maybe even out in the countryside are going to come and dig in your compost to pull out that meat or fat or whatever it is you've thrown in.
And make a mess.
And make a big mess. Now, the not so obvious reason is that there's some bacteria and some really nasty microorganisms that live and will, in the process of breaking down that slab of meat, will then cause some problems with contamination of material. And you put that into your soil, it grows into a plant, and you eat that, and so you consume that, and there's nothing to break that chain.
So it's basically a hygiene thing, almost. Like, are we talking about things like hepatitis or E. coli?
Exactly,
or,
yeah.
Yeah. So the type of thing to put in the compost pile is plant material.
Yes.
And sometimes chopping it up or shredding it helps the composting action, helps the breakdown.
Yeah.
Leaves, and then you mix a certain amount of soil in to begin with, huh? A little bit or
yeah.
not?
From time to time you can mix in some soil, and that just provides, because at the end, whenever you're finished, you want to be able to put that back onto your soil. So if you're mixing soil in, then it helps to give it some of that loaminess and less, just rotting plant matter. The soil also can absorb out some of the moisture if it gets too wet at the bottom, and it can help it be less of a muddy mud pie mess.
Yeah.
If you can imagine, and more of a nice, soft soil or earth material.
Yeah. Along the lines of talking polluting factors, and we were talking about E. coli or hepatitis and the like, animal manure is considered a good additive, like cow manure, or I know that chicken manure needs to cook down a little bit in a compost pile before you put it on your garden, because of the chemical nature of it. It's too strong and will burn the plants and burn the seeds, and they die, rather than grow in it. But what about human manure and human diseases like hepatitis and the like? I've heard that some Asian countries, for instance, will use human manure almost directly into their fields for fertilizer, and that this can be a problem in contamination, in that it gets into the food supply. Do you have any familiarity with that?
Well, I know that there's a couple of places where they do use human manure to fertilize some fields. But the biggest concern is you have to break that chain somehow. You can't go from, human waste to directly to plant application and reconsume that. It needs to be, somehow that chain has to be broken. And what do I mean when I say break the chain? The direct cycle has to be broken. There has to be some chance for it to be converted to some other form. The best way to do that is to compost it. And where you're putting the chicken manure into the compost and letting it cook down, you're doing that automatically. I would say that with the concerns about avian flu, that it's even more important now to do that as well, and not just direct apply to your garden.
Yeah, the other day we had an hour with a fellow who had composted a lot, and he claimed that a 2-year cycle would break down almost anything. In other words, in your compost pile, if you had some manure that had some germs that required a beast, such as a cow or a chicken or whatever, to live, or a human body, that after 2 years in the compost pile of turning and cooking and breaking down into soil, that germ wasn't there anymore. Because it required, it couldn't just sit in the soil for 2 years and be viable. It had lost its viability. Some things like anthrax, I guess, are more durable and live in the soil and form some sort of a cyst, and are able to get into a cut and cause a problem, an anthrax infection. But others that we're talking about here, the viruses, they don't survive, and they cook out. So you cook your compost long enough for a 2-year period and cook it down, it's safe to use on your garden, and you're not going to get infection from that. That's, that was the general impression.
2 years would be long enough for
almost
everything I can imagine.
And
in some cases, you wouldn't even need to wait 2 years. If you have a healthy community, whether it be a family or some other community of people that are cooperating in this garden.
And you know there's no infection,
exactly.
You know, that you're worried about passing on, like then hepatitis.
Then you could take the waste and put it into the compost, cook it down, you know, and get away with a shorter period of time.
Yep, sounds right. So now in planting a garden, you know, what kind of a range of plants you're hoping that the sunlight will be bright, and you wouldn't be having a garden if you didn't have some sunlight, if only a dim sunlight you were going for. There's so many plants to choose from. We tend to think of things like carrots and tomatoes and broccoli, and that's it. You know, but actually there's a wide variety of plants that we can choose from. In greenery, for instance, Swiss chard, spinach, various kinds of lettuce. We even had a mustard green that is a salad green, kind of spicy, that is a salad food. And all of these are greens, collard greens, etc. What surprised me is that many of these, in fact, are not annuals. You know, lettuce is where you put the seed in, it pops up, then it bolts the seed when it gets hot enough, and you collect the seed, and the next year you do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Spinach is, to collect seed from spinach, I found that it's sexual. Some plants are male, some plants are female. You got to have both in there. And then it's only the females that have the little seeds, and the males die a little earlier, and they get kind of feathery looking because they are pollinating, and they die off a little earlier. Swiss chard, which we just love, is in fact a biennial.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have that in the garden for the next year. It goes to seed. And if you can't keep it over, like in the root cellar, or you don't have a mild climate where you can just kind of cover it and keep it from a hard freeze, you won't get that second year, and you don't get the seed. So, what's your favorite greenery?
I would have to say that garden sorrel, or French sorrel sometimes called, it would be my all-around favorite. The taste is a bit sharp, like mustard green, but it actually is very rich in vitamin C. And in fact, it has more vitamin C per serving than oranges or any of the other citrus fruits.
So what does this look like? I'm not sure that I've seen that. We have a lot of weeds, and there's one weed that people call a sourgrass or a sorrel, and I'm not sure that that's it. But this one looks kind of like a four-leaf clover with a little yellow flower. Is the sorrel you're talking about that?
It's more like spinach. It's a broad leaf, and it will actually grow a big bunch and gets a bit taller than spinach. The variety that I've grown was called just garden sorrel, and it's grew to about 18 inches tall.
Wow. I'm going to have to get some.
It's really awesome stuff. Grows very well in all conditions. I actually was growing it in a very shady spot, and it did very well, and it resisted that urge to bolt the seed in that shady spot for a good portion of the summer. It doesn't come up. You have to wait a bit. It doesn't grow in the same cool environment as spinach. It prefers to be planted more in April or even May. And then it does very well. It grows a very tall seed stalk, and the seeds are very small and hard to harvest, but it does seed itself and come back again in
the next
years in that same location.
Yeah, neat. So it's an annual. It goes to seed. I'll have to look into that, especially because it will grow in dim light, in the shade. Speaking of the climate, as you were saying, what's warm and what's not, some plants leap up and sprout up when it's cool and really bear through into some of the early frosts. Like our Swiss chard will go out and pick it even after we've had a few frosts, it seems, and get frozen. But there's other plants that if I try to put them in the garden too soon before the soil has warmed up, they just molder in the ground. And I'm talking here about beans in particular. they will not sprout if the soil isn't warm. Instead, they end up moldering. So the soil temperature is, a lot of plants are particular about that. Some like the cool weather, like spinach, etc. And by the time the weather is even warmed up, they've bolted the seed and they're saying bye-bye because it's too warm for them. And others won't even germinate unless the soil is warm. And they're going by the soil temperature, aren't they, more than the air temperature?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
If it's a very sunny spring, it can raise that soil temperature for shallow seeds, and they can sprout early. They also need to have a certain amount of moisture to sprout as well, except that damp soil doesn't get warmed up as well. So it's a catch-22 in some of those things. Like I'm thinking of peas, for instance. They are typically an early spring germinator. But if the soil is too moist, then they will just rot away.
Yep.
And mold away.
Yep. I've had times when I've seeded my beans, and then it stayed cool, and nothing came up, and went out again, and reseeded the beans, and boom, I have every seed sprouts, and it's a bean plant. So there's carrot, things like rutabagas or turnips, and different root crops like that. A lot of these plants really want to propagate via the root. In other words, the first year you put seed down, yes, you get a carrot, rutabaga, or whatever, but the next year the carrot wants to go to seed, and it's a biennial kind of a cycle where most of the cabbage products are that way too. You get a cabbage head, and the next year the cabbage head wants to put up a stalk, a long, tall stalk with fine little pods that shatter and have these tiny little seeds in that are almost like a pinprick in size. They're tiny. But some are, some biennials, like we have a broccoli variety that has gone to seed the very first year. I was
broccoli
quite
is
pleased.
Actually an annual.
It's an annual?
Uh-huh. It will seed every year.
Ah. So I was thrilled about that because I tried one year to save my cabbage and put it in the root cellar and bring it out and go for cabbage seed, green cabbage.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a disaster. I had a mold problem. I don't know why. The cabbage was just maybe more prone to mold, and we had a rainy year that year. So I was using some sort of a chemical additive, you know, to keep the mold from the cabbage that I put in the root cellar, and brought them out and lost the whole crop anyway to the mold residue. So it was a disaster, and I was very carefully wrapping them up for the root cellar, dried them out, put them in band in some cases, and didn't have a heck of a lot of luck. But under normal circumstances where you have a fairly mild climate, a root cellar wouldn't be necessary. You just leave that carrot or cabbage in the ground, cover it, and then let it go to seed the next year, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
If you can control the environment, keep it nice and warm or heavily mulched, then most of the time you can winter those things over in a warmer climate. Of course, in the northern part of this country, that wouldn't be possible.
Not possible.
But where it's dry like that, in the northern regions of this country, what you do is just to take that plant, cabbage for instance, you turn it upside down and you store it in your root cellar, and the root cellar is dry because the air is dry. It's somewhat moist because the root cellar is exposed to the soil, so it won't completely dry the plant out, but it will be dry enough to keep the mold from growing.
Maybe that's where I went wrong. I was wrapping it in newspaper. I was, I think, more concerned about it drying out too much, and maybe that's where I approached it wrong. So you turn them upside down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hang them from the roots, from the rootstock, and that will tend to keep the moisture into the plant. But then they should just be exposed to the air, and probably wrapping them in newspaper traps too much moisture in it.
That's what I did wrong. Well, what I do know is you're supposed to have it dark, right? The root cellar is not supposed to have light in it. Otherwise, the plant says, ah, spring, and wants to take off. So just cool, dry place, not freezing, but not warm.
But not too warm,
Yeah.
We're looking at, you're looking at about between 40 and 50 degrees. It's a nice temperature range for most things. Potatoes just love that 40 to 50 degree range. And will stay in dormancy for more than a winter. If you can keep it that way, they'll stay in dormancy for, they really get shriveled after about 6 months. I've seen potatoes that were wintered over for as much as 9 months. They were dug early June, and planted again in May almost. And they were wintered, for nearly 9 months, and then brought out to the sun to try to sprout them back up again, and they did, and grew successfully.
Wow. Another root cellar item, and this is not for plant propagation, but just storing your food without, let's say we don't have refrigerators, let's say we don't have electricity, but we have a garden, winter squash and pumpkins and potatoes keep very well in a cool, dark place, as do apples. Squash is one of the most aggressive plants that I've ever encountered in the garden. Needs a lot of room. You've got to give it, put a plant in, and it can be like almost a 6-foot radius around that bed where you put the squash or pumpkin plants in, covered with these vines. The leaves seem to be as big as twice as big as my head, and lobbing out into the lawn, very aggressive. But a pumpkin or a squash, a winter squash, will keep very well, and you can bake it later. All you have to do is tuck that stuff away in a cool, dry place. Am I right?
Exactly, yeah. With some squash, some of the winter squash, you can avoid that tendency of it to just grow all over the lawn by encouraging it to grow upwards on something like a tomato cage. They will climb a trellis or a cage like a tomato cage and then grow from there. And then you see these squash hanging like bells or something if it's butternut squash. And it looks quite interesting. And they save space that way. But something more of a heavy nature like a pumpkin or watermelon, for instance, or even cantaloupe or muskmelon, you wouldn't want to do because the fruit is just too heavy to hang from a cage like that.
Yeah, and lifting tomatoes off is as much to get it off the ground where slugs and the like don't come along and eat it. I know I've done it both ways. I've had fences where I've pulled my tomato plants up and tied them along the fence so that they would be off the ground. And you usually have a clean tomato that doesn't have bugs and slugs and the like, or not subject to being getting moldy real quick. And other years, I've just let it be on the ground where you can often lose a good portion of the crop that way. You have to catch them before they're fully ripe and cut them, otherwise they start to go laying on the ground. And speaking of that, another area that I wanted to talk about was seed saving, because there is such a difference in people buy seed in little packets and they say, oh, isn't this nice, clean seed? Apparently you just sort of collect it. Well, a lot of plants are like that, where you just collect, like lettuce is one, or where a bean plant, you just let that pod get very dry until you can almost hear it rattle in there, and shuck those beans out, and that's a real easy, or corn is another one, easy to collect. But a lot of seeds, it's tricky. For instance, tomato, and I was surprised to learn when I first started seed saving about 5 years ago that you have to let it molder, let a white mold get on the top and stir that around, let it molder for several days, then rinse it off, or you'll never get that tomato seed to germinate. And the reason is there's like a slime on the tomato seed, and the tomato seed thinks it's still inside the tomato if that doesn't molder off. If it molders off, it says, oh, I've dropped to the ground and I've moldered, so it's okay, now I'm on the soil and I can sprout. And that makes the difference. So A lot of seed. I've heard that even muskmelon can benefit from being moldered rather than just washed. Is that right?
I'm not too sure about the muskmelon. I never saved seeds from that. Neither did my father. So, but certainly tomatoes are that way. Potato seeds would be the same way because they're closely related to tomatoes. But that's all the familiarity I have with that. Of course, any good seed-saving Bible would tell you for sure which ones need to be fermented or molded.
Yeah, mainly they don't. I know tomatoes, it's the big one that does. And talking about potatoes, I've heard that potatoes, the best and fastest way to propagate them is to take a potato and cut it up into the little eye parts. Each little eye wants to be a sprout that'll rise up out of those, and you just put those pieces in the ground, and voila, each one becomes a potato plant. That saving seed is very difficult. So I was surprised to hear you say saving seed from potatoes. I tried that one year. I was looking for the potato seed, and sure enough, it got blossoms, and each of those blossoms had kind of like a little ball thing. And the next time I'd look, the ball seemed to have disappeared. I think it fell onto the ground, dried up and fell onto the ground and couldn't find it. So I never did get any seeds. But do you actually get seeds from potato plants?
I did one year. I was successful. I got those balls, and they look, you cut them open, they look just like tomatoes, except they don't have nearly as much juice. And so I added a lot of water and fermented the seed, and the seed didn't sprout. It wasn't viable.
Really?
So it's not the best method to propagate the potatoes. You really need to do it with the eyes and super to tubers. But if you can, try to save the seed because, you know, that's your genetic diversity there.
Yes.
And sometimes you run into some problems whenever you are cloning the plant, which is what you do when you plant from a tuber. I can mention the great Irish potato famine as a prime example of what happens if you just plant one variety of potatoes over and over and over again by cloning a plant that way. Eventually, that plant can become susceptible to some new disease, and you'll lose your whole crop, and then what?
Wow.
You know, so.
Might be a good idea to have more than one variety of potatoes on hand and plant them.
Exactly.
Yeah, and never plant your last, and never eat your last potato, right?
Right, yeah.
Now, I've also heard that potatoes benefit from a good drained soil, and that one reason people say, well, take an old tire and put it on the ground, fill that with soil, so that really it's a raised bed, and the potato plant that's in there, it won't get soggy. The ground is not soggy, and the potato likes that. Some plants like a raised bed. I'm thinking that there are some melons that are supposedly like that. They prefer a well-drained soil.
Yeah.
One way to do that is to pull the soil up into a mound, and that automatically gives that better drainage.
Uh-huh.
And other seed is very fragile, like in the cabbage family or the mustard family, it's like a little pod that it dries quickly, and all of a sudden it opens, and the seed is just dropped on the ground, and it's like little tiny pinpricks in size, and you'd never find it. So you have to actually cut that pod at some point before it's fully dried, and hang it over in a piece of paper somewhere where if the seeds fall out on the paper, you know, you can collect them. Or put it in a tray and let it dry, and then collect the seeds that break and fall in the tray. So other seeds are like spinach. It just shuck them off the stalk, and you have to actually work at it to get them to separate, so there's no chance of losing them. Now, talking about seeds, seeds can last an awful long time. I saw something recently. There was like a 2,000-year-old seed that had germinated, but that's on the extreme end.
Very, very extreme.
Right? In most cases, you were telling me at one time that it's kind of a percentage thing, you know, that if a seed is expected to last 20 years, you might have only 1% germinating after 20 years, and maybe after 2 or 3 years, you might find that you have 87% germinating. It's like a sliding scale, right?
Yeah, something like that. I would use the example of beans. My father collects beans and maintains close to 150 different varieties of beans in his seed bank as a member of the Seed Savers Exchange. And really, he's found that after about 5 years, his germination starts to fall off at about 10 or 15% per year. And he'll do test germination throughout that five-year process and keep a lot of good records as far as which varieties. Because each variety is different as well. Some varieties only last 3 years, and some can easily go 7 to 10 years without any trouble at all.
Yeah, I've been surprised. I did a germination test after about 5 years here, and I was thrilled to see how well the meal corn and tomatoes did, just real close to 100%, and I was happy. You know, you worry about it. Just on the other hand, some seed, but rarely, like onion, I think is supposed to be quite fragile and not last that long.
Yeah, they recommend every 2 to 3 years that you should grow out everything that you have, because after that, your germination will drop off.
Yeah.
Almost like a falling rock.
Yeah, wow, that fast. Well, also, the main thing about saving seed is it should be very, very dry, and you should keep it out of the light, out of the heat, but mainly it's dry, right?
Yeah.
I've heard people say it's kind of like the old tobacco tin, and, you know, stuff the seeds in there and cap it up and put it in the barn, which means that it would be, you know, frozen during the winter and out of the light and out of the heat. Some air in that can, but not too much, that type of thing. The main rule on Seed Savers is never plant your last seed. Always hold something back. And the idea being, you never know if you're going to have a crop failure, some terrible thing happen, you know, whether it's a drought or a windstorm and your entire garden gets wiped out and you cannot get seed from what you planted. So the idea being you always hold back a little and make sure that you never plant your last seed.
Definitely.
Yeah. Here in Wisconsin, the soil is so very rich that the weed patch that develops is overwhelming. If you don't get in there and hoe and pull, you can't even find your garden after a bit. I've heard that some, like the American Indians techniques, were to not till, not turn over the soil, but to plant, for instance, a lot of corn in a hill and put a fish or two in there for the nitrogen fertilizer. And not worry about the weeds, that the plant would be tall enough, the corn or whatever. So they didn't plow, but our Western techniques are to plow everything and let the soil blow in the wind like the Dust Bowl. So are there variations between those two extremes that you're aware of?
Definitely. My family of spouses, the whole biointensive gardening techniques, otherwise known as like square foot gardening or raised gardening, raised bed gardening. It's not a new technique, really. It's older than this row crop method that we use now. Again, when our country innovated new agricultural techniques and discovered automation and so on, it was more of benefit to just run a long row and drive your tractor down it than to intensify your space and work in a garden bed. We bed, still garden in beds. Even today, we call them flower beds. And we cut down on weeds in those flower beds by just overplanting, interplanting, and really using every bit of space possible. We mulch around the plants when we plant them in the spring, and then you don't till, you don't plow, you just keep your soil worked up by hand and replant when you need to if you're planting annuals and so on. So if you use those same techniques that you use in your flower bed in a garden, you accomplish the same thing. You don't have a big weed problem in the space where you're growing your garden plants, because the garden plants are close enough together that, you know, they're shoulder to shoulder and they keep all the weeds from growing. You still get some weeds that'll come through. Grasses, for instance, will push through and make their way. But for the most part, you have this self-shielding, the plants just really take over and get the weeds out.
Yeah, I've noticed that in my garden, that I really only have weeds not real close to the plants because there's no sunlight under there, mm-hmm. and there it's bare ground. But it's in the open areas that the weeds take form and spread out.
Exactly.
One thing that has come up to be a concern is the fact that our bee population in the North American continent has some sort of a mite that is killing bees in their hives. And people are saying, oh dear, if we don't have bees, how will we ever pollinate our crops? But in fact, a lot of different insects can be pollinators. Isn't that true? I find on my plants in the garden, it's not just the bees and the bumblebees, but various flying insects are landing on the blossoms, and ants are crawling all over them, and little beetle types are. Any insect that crawls around and is attracted to the blossoms is going to be spreading the pollen, right?
Exactly, yeah. Most plants that you plant in a garden are not really relying so much on insects, bees or flies or any of those other things to pollinate them. Very many of them are self-pollinating and don't require anything at all. That the bloom is closed. Peas and beans, for instance, are this way, and they don't need any action at all to pollinate.
Tomatoes too. I know I've heard that they're self-pollinators.
Yeah,
as well as the
beans. Bloom is small enough that the pollen.
Balls in there.
Just right there.
Yeah.
Tomatoes can still crop, and if you're growing more than one variety, you have to be mindful of that and separate them over distance. And the way they cross is by air.
Yeah.
And wind pollination is the second largest form of pollination among garden varieties.
Certainly does it for the corn. Corn is entirely wind pollinated.
Exactly.
And that plume at the top is the male pollen. And then the silk that comes out of the corn cob is the female part catching that on the wind. And if you have, I know they say half a mile or more, keep your corn crops apart if you don't want crossing.
Exactly.
Because of the wind.
Yeah.
So if one wanted to be...
hand pollinate. And corn is very good for that. If you want to make sure that you're keeping your corn seeds, because you've got a couple of varieties and you can't get them separated, then you should just take some of the pollen in your hand and pollinate the silk yourself, and then cover it so it can't be pollinated by any other pollen in the area.
Yeah. What about covering or mulching for the winter? A lot of people, like if you have strawberries or something, and would you put leaves around the strawberries or something to keep them to protect them from hard freeze or hard winds?
Of course. You want to consider the best mulching material that you have available. Leaves pull a lot of nitrogen out of the soil and can form some acids, like we talked about. And for some varieties of plants, that may not be the best thing. Straw, for instance, is another readily available mulching material, but also when it begins to decompose, it can pull a lot of nitrogen out of your soil and not be a benefit. Prairie hay, if you were to get that and use it, you might be actually making more of a problem than what you're trying to do, and that prairie hay has a lot of weeds, seeds in it, and so you may be feeding your garden with weeds that you'll be pulling for the next couple of years. It's really the best material for mulching that I recommend would be alfalfa, because it is cut green. It usually doesn't have a problem with weeds growing in the field of alfalfa, and it works very well for the mulching material. You can also use wood chips in some areas. People use them all the time in their flower beds. Again, wood chips are very much like the leaves, and they start to decompose, and it takes a while, but eventually it starts to decompose, and they're going to pull a lot of nitrogen out of your soil. But different wood chips are less prone to decomposition. Cedar chips, for instance, they tend to last a long time before they start to break down.
And mulching retains the moisture in the soil, and especially if you're in any kind of a droughty area, and your baby plants don't dry out as quickly. In some cases, unlikely to be after the pole shift, when we're going to have gloomy weather rather than intense sun, But some people will actually cover their garden with some sort of a gauzy shield because the sun is too intensive and it's burning their plant. And I'm wondering about wind shades also. If a person is in an area where the wind is blowing a lot and whipping the plants, if one can't put up a fence or something to keep the plants from being whipped around or blown down, more likely, because a strong wind can blow down plants, and there goes your seed saving. Certainly, I had an experience with some onions. I'm growing gypsy onions here, which do not require a seed pod with those beautiful white flowers on the end of a delicate pod to get seed, because I had a windstorm once, and just as it was all going to seed, and wham, all my beautiful flower pods were laid on the ground. Those stalks were snapped, and I decided I'd have better luck with the gypsy onion variety, where the little onions are grown at the end of the stalks and lob over and land on the ground to start a new plant. So, do you, where you are, because I know you're in Kansas, and they have winds out there, don't they?
Yeah.
Do you use windbreaks at all?
I never have. I've been very fortunate in not needing that. The heavy winds usually come during the height of the growing season, and so you can usually get by with just going back out and propping your plants back up when they've been blown over in a thunderstorm. As long as you don't have a tornado that goes through and just decimates everything, then you're pretty, plants are pretty forgiven, and they'll reroot and come back just fine. In August, whenever you're starting to harvest the seed, the storms aren't as prevalent. And we do get some pretty high winds, but for the most part, by then, the plants have become really strong, really tough, from being laid over a couple of times in a thunderstorm. And we'll do fine without a windbreak.
I end up in toward the end of my gardening season running around with poles. I push poles in, and I'm tying my plants up, mm-hmm. and you know, try on all sides of the pole, like, so that they brace each other. One thing that I had a problem with the first year we were here, we planted soybeans in the garden, and we had a problem with rabbits, where the rabbits would go directly to that soybean patch and eat those beans down to the ground.
Yeah.
They didn't go after the lettuce. They didn't go after the other beans. They didn't go after the carrots. Just, there must have been something in the soybeans that they were hungry for, and I had to, like, be real aggressive with fencing, or I wasn't going to get any seed at all from that. We were growing it for seed. So you have a problem, like, what's the standard way of, other than fencing, other than getting a gun and popping them off when they appear, you know, how do you control gophers and rabbits, considering from the standpoint of somebody who's a survival community and they can't go and get any kind of, like, poisons or whatever. They're stuck with a natural way. Fencing only goes so far because rabbits are, they can squeeze under a fence and work their way around pretty aggressively.
When I had a gopher problem one year, I would just go out every day and take a stick and poke it down into his tunnels until I found him. And the way I found him was he squeaked whenever I poked the stick down. And so I immediately poked that stick down a little bit to the left or to the right, I don't remember, and pulled out a stab to gopher. And it was rather messy, and luckily my daughter was not around when I was doing this, but that took care of my problem. And sometimes that's just what you have to do.
That's what you have to do. We have some feral cats that adopted us, and I've been feeding, and I mean to tell you, that's a solution.
Yeah.
Not only do we not have any mice, and I even saw one of them flipping a dead rat around in the garden, you know, a sewer rat, I suppose. I haven't seen a rabbit and since they showed up. And the gophers, they got rid of the gophers. Well, thank you so much, Roger, for being with us and sharing all this information.
Hello, I'm Roger, president of Troubled Times Incorporated. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping mankind survive during troubled times when self-sufficiency may be the only answer. Our organization offers a twin set CD of survival information at cost to the public. The CDs are in hypertext and PDF format, two popular browser formats, and contain all the information collected by the massive Troubled Times website. The CDs allow you to browse this information offline at your leisure. The cost of the twinned pair is $4.10, and this includes postage. You can also get the survival booklet, a hip-size booklet of the gist of the Troubled Times advice, for just $5, including postage. We offer a popular combo package for $7.50 that includes both the CDs and the booklet, with the lower postage expense reflected in that price. Send for your copies today to start making practical plans for your and your family's survival. Just click on the $4.10 CD link at www.zetatalk.com, and your copy will be on its way.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.